December 7th, 1941. It's the day the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, killing 2,043 Americans, wounding 1,178 more. The day the United States found the national resolve to finally enter World War II. It was 75 years ago. Here's Eleanor Roosevelt in an interview from the 1950s describing the first time she saw her husband, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, following the attack.
Almost the first thing he said to me was, with great bitterness and anger, that actually he had hardly finished talking to the Japanese envoys when this was being done in Pearl Harbor.
FDR's bitterness and anger gave way to a battle cry, though, that on the very next day set America on a course that in many ways we're still on.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Paul Sparrow is the director of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum.
We have to remember that this was a seminal moment in American history. You know, this was the worst day in Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, worst day in his life, worst military defeat in American history. And yet, you know, from that smoking wreckage emerged a great leader. He was able to lift the weight of the free world on his paralyzed legs and carry it into the future, and in the process transform America from an isolationist nation into a global superpower. At that point in 1941, America had the 14th largest standing army, you know, behind Sweden. We were not a significant military power, although Roosevelt had been attempting to prepare America for an eventual entry into this war. The American public was resistant. They were isolationists. The isolationists had a majority in Congress. So this was a transformative moment, and it laid the foundation for everything that's happened since then, both the evolution of the military-industrial complex and America as the world's policeman, but also 75 years of peace.
Was there talk at the time that Roosevelt's paralyzed legs wouldn't be strong enough to carry the nation through this crisis?
Well, there were certainly people who felt that he had misled America in the 1940 election. The 1940 election was highly controversial, the first time anyone had ever run for a third term. And there was great distrust of his wanting to become a dictator. They knew that he was a strong ally of Great Britain and Russia, and that he wanted to get in on the war on the Allied side. So there was some sense that he was not being totally honest with the American public during that election. But he was consistent, and he said, you know, we will not get into this war unless we are attacked. And so he waited and waited for the attack. The criticism about him was that he might have had advanced knowledge of the attack, for which there is absolutely no documentary evidence, but it is a conspiracy theory that survives to this day.
Did he ever visit Pearl Harbor? Did he have close contact with the survivors and the wounded from Pearl Harbor?
He did visit Pearl Harbor later on in the war. He had a meeting there with General MacArthur and Admiral Halsey and the other military leaders in the Pacific conflict, although that wasn't until 1944. He had very close ties to the Navy. He had been the Assistant Secretary of the Navy during World War I, and he served under President Wilson. He was actually at the keel laying for the battleship Arizona, which of course was sunk at Pearl Harbor. He knew personally the captains of a number of the ships that were destroyed or damaged at Pearl Harbor.
What kind of leadership did FDR have to bring forth that wasn't already a part of his political life?
The key part of his leadership at this point was to get America to come together despite what had been extensive public opposition to getting involved in this war. So the speech was critically important. He was only going to have a few moments to take the American public and shift them from one point of view to the other. And he called his assistant in, Grace Tully, and dictated the speech to her. And as she described in her memoirs, He leaned back and he took a drag on his cigarette, and then he basically dictated the entire speech to her in one take, no stops, including punctuation. She then went and typed it up and brought it back to him, and he kept it with him for the rest of the day, and he would make these edits on it using pencil. And of course, he made what's considered one of the most famous edits, you know, in presidential speeches, which the first line originally read December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in world history. And he crosses out world history and writes in the word infamy. And at that moment, he knew that after, you know, several years of trying to prepare America for the entry into this war, he now had to lead it.
I don't want to draw you into any controversy, but, you know, looking back at our response to 9/11 and some of the things that have happened in my lifetime, why is the response to an attack like this to sometimes just go completely at odds to our core values, which is what the Japanese internment order was and what many have said the consequences of the invasion of Iraq has been?
Well, there's always that balancing act between national security and our liberties, our civil liberties. It is a specter who's reappeared throughout every major military conflict we've been involved in. Abraham Lincoln, you know, overturned habeas corpus, you know, in World War I, they were arresting newspaper editors who, or even people who were conscientious objectors. So this is a pattern of American behavior where, when threatened, Americans tend to sacrifice their civil liberties in the name of national security. I think what happens over time then is that people realize there is an overreaction, and then the pendulum swings back into a more balanced approach towards the importance of civil liberties, towards our core American values, and understanding that national security means nothing if we're not defending those things that we believe in. And that was one of Roosevelt's key points in his vision for the future. When he first came out with his Four Freedoms speech in January of 1941, he said, "We're fighting not for the British Empire. We're fighting for the freedom of speech, for the freedom of religion, for the freedom from want, for the freedom from fear, that an attack on freedom anywhere is an attack on freedom everywhere." And that's what he was trying to convince both the Americans and the global community of, and why this war was worth fighting. And I think we should always go back to that statement of his, which is that as Americans, we represent much more than just one country. We represent an ideal of democracy that people all over the world aspire to, and we have to understand that our actions have consequence, but our values are what motivate people all over the world.
Paul Sparrow, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Paul Sparrow is the director of the Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum. And let's leave you with this moment of Roosevelt rallying the nation 75 years ago.
We are now in this war. We're all in it, all the way. Every single man, woman, and child is a partner in the most tremendous undertaking of our American history. We must share together the bad news and the good news, the defeats and the victories, the changing fortunes of war.
President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's fireside chat on December 9th, 1941. What would you say? How good are we at that sharing of the bad news and the good news, the defeats and the victories today in the changing fortunes of war and peace? Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Huckaberry. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.